It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 662 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you're ready for another great doubleheader episode this week, this time beginning with Ahoy Comics' new Toxic Avenger miniseries creators, Matt Boers and Fred Harper. Then concluding with Danny Hellman from Jacked Tracts, which is crowdfunding on Zoop.gg. The episode starts with my fun interview with writer Matt Boers, returning to the podcast, and first-time appearance by artist Fred Harper. They're bringing a new take on Toxic Avenger, which is being described this way. It's an all-new 5-issue comic book series starring the Toxic Avenger, the satirical hero of the trauma cult classic films. Having already spawned 5 films, a cartoon action figure line, a musical, and a Marvel comic book series, the Toxic Avenger is a pulp culture icon. We talk about how this new miniseries came to be, who the characters are, and what we can expect from these two creators in the months ahead. The first issue has just been released, so be sure to check with your local comic shop, who can order the books for you if they don't already have a copy in stock. Then everything wraps up with my excellent conversation with Jacked Tracts creator Danny Hellman, who has this current crowdfunding project underway with Zoop.gg. Here's the description. Jacked Tracts is a spirited satire of those notorious Christian comic tracts that thrilled and traumatized American kids throughout the late 20th century. Its rollicking re-examination of these comics from a contemporary perspective is sure to delight believers and heathens alike. Danny discusses how this book came to be, who the characters and creators are, and what else he has coming our way soon. Be sure to back this already successful crowdfunder before it concludes this Wednesday, October 16. I'm sure you're going to enjoy what they all have to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. In the Toxic Avenger, teenager Melvin Junko helps run his parents' junkyard in Tromaville, a small town in New Jersey where nothing much ever happens until an ill-timed train derailment of toxic waste transforms Melvin into a hideously deformed creature of superhuman size and strength, the Toxic Avenger. Under a media blackout imposed by Biohazard Solutions, BS, of course, and their PR spewing chairwoman, Lindsay Flick, Melvin emerges as the hero fighting against BS and the mutated threats that keep popping up around Tromaville. Eventually, Melvin uncovers a vast conspiracy, more far-reaching than he could have ever imagined. But he knows if everyone is simply made aware of the crisis, they'll act to stop it, right? Yeah, sure. And what's happening now is the Toxic Avenger, number one of a 5-issue miniseries from Ahoy Comics, is now released. And I'm talking today with creators Matt Boers, the founder of The Nib and a political cartoonist who has been twice named a Pulitzer Prize finalist, and acclaimed artist Fred Harper from Snelson. And the first issue, like I said, is coming out. It's going to be a 5-issue miniseries. So let's see. Welcome back, Matt. How are you?
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having us.
It's good to talk with you. And Fred, this is your first time. How are you doing?
Oh, so far, so good. I had 2 espressos and I'm ready to go.
Okay. Wow.
I was watching a thing and made me smile. They have this thing in a local station where I grew up where they have people call in and they say things about what's going on in the programming. And somebody posed the question, how many drinks do you have before you call into this this thing? And we're getting all kinds of answers now. Of course, some people say nothing. I'd never do that. But other people saying, yeah, I have to get Gooden's house before I can get on there. So I'm entertained by all that stuff. That just makes me laugh. But so the Toxic Avenger, Matt, let's start with you and talk about what was it like to take on a well-known franchise like the Toxic Avenger?
It's great. It's been great. It's my first time ever doing a licensed character. And I mean, to me, it feels pretty natural because I've had a Toxic Avenger, this idea for a while, a few years, really. I mean, it evolved, the story evolved, but the idea that, you know, I could do something with it had been in my head a while. And I was doing political cartoons and nonfiction, running the Nib. And then that ended last year and I closed the publication down and, you know, I was sort of consciously moving into comic books, like proper comic books, monthly comic books, at least, and genre comics. And this was at the top of my list as something to try to do. I mean, no one had, you know, it's not like trying to write Batman. Every cartoonist or every comic book writer wants to get on Batman and it sells, you know, tons of copies every month. But like no one had done anything with the Toxic Avenger for a long time, which was odd to me. And, you know, there could have been all sorts of reasons why that is. And maybe it was going to be hard to make it happen, but it actually went super smoothly. And here we are.
Wow. Okay. But so you approached them?
Yeah, I was at Comic-Con last year in San Diego. I was up for an Eisner for the Nib, which we won. And, you know, it was sad because we were closing the Nib, but I was also, I was like in pitch mode because I was trying to make some other things happen. I didn't really have a lot of work lined up, frankly. And just so happened, I saw that Trauma had a booth there. I mean, I didn't even know Lloyd Kaufman was going to be there. And I figured, you know, I might as well shoot my shot. And I went up and introduced myself and said I had an idea for a new Toxic Avenger comic. And he was pretty receptive. I didn't really hard pitch him then and there. It was more like, you know, email me and here's my card type stuff, which, you know, stuff could come from or not at all, right? But I followed up. I wrote an outline for a whole pitch, and they were into it. And I sort of married them with Ahoy, my publisher on Justice Warriors. And like I said, it went pretty smoothly. Everybody was on board, and it was great.
Okay, so Fred, how did you get involved with this?
I'm a hanger around. I've been doing little things for Ahoy here and there, and I told them to keep me in mind for anything new that came up, and they know I work with Stuart Moore on a few projects, actually. One was The Wrong Earth, and then we did name is escaping me all of a sudden. I only did it all year so I can't.
Snelson. Highball.
Highball. Yeah, that's it. Cause I don't drink like that. So it's all about highball. But highball, I got, you know, it took me a while to get through that. And it was during COVID. And then after I got that out of my system, you know, it was like I was just floating around, and I do editorial illustration for magazines and newspapers. That stuff's drying up, so finally, you know, they called me while I was on a train going back to New York from Albany, and Tom Pear calls, emailed me and was like, "Hey, do you want to do this thing, Toxic Avenger?" And I'm like, "Oh my gosh, I've heard of that one, you know." So I of course I want to do that, you know. And you know, it's just I had an immediate flashback to when I was in college and the first time I saw the movie, and I was like, "Oh yeah, that was insane. I have to be part of this if I can." And so, yeah, they, you know, I'd already been in the Ahoy group in there and just floating around until the right project came by, and this was it.
Okay, now I got to ask, of course, Matt, we'll go back to you and see, were you a toxic, obviously you must have been a toxic Avenger fan prior to this.
Yeah, I watched the movies and the cartoon, Toxic Crusaders, when I was a little kid, and I had the toys and stuff. And, you know, it always stuck with me. I mean, if you watch the movies, especially a lot of people my age, I think, watched them when they were real young. And some of that stuff really sticks with me, you know, like Toxie ripping out a guy's intestines and skipping rope with them. Classic. You know, I was probably, who knows how old I was when I was, I don't even remember watching it for the first time. You know, I was probably 7. Who knows? So yeah, although there hasn't really been anything done with them in so long. So it's like, you know, it's hard to say I'm a fan necessarily. I mean, I am, I guess, but like there wasn't much to be a fan of other than the stuff that I watched when I was a kid. You know, I hadn't gone back and watched the cartoon or anything. It just always seemed, I mean, I'm a satire guy. I like mutants and dystopia, and it just seems like a perfect character to explore that stuff. So it was at the top of my list.
Okay, great. Now, Fred, you were saying that you were aware of it. You weren't much of a fan though, right?
No, yeah, I hadn't thought of it really at all until they brought it up to me, because I just in general enjoy like you know, those older grindhouse movie type things, you know, where it's like it's just a ridiculous idea and then they do horrible special effects, and I just find that entertaining, you know, like wow, they don't do that anymore. That would have been CGI and it would have been really gross, but this is really gross, but also I can see how they did it. And that's just as entertaining to me. And so I ended up just kind of like re-immersing myself once they asked me to get familiar with everything, because I'm like, oh, I think I know it, but I really didn't. And so yeah, it was opened up a new chapter of study for me.
Cool. All right. Now, Matt, of course, I've got a question. Whenever you've got an established franchise, you have fans. And I always think of Star Trek, because Trekkies, you know, they did a survey one time. They wanted to do they didn't know whether they should do a Klingon novel or a Trek romance novel. And it came in 50-50. And I always think fans know what they would like. And I always worry when you get into an established franchise, are there limits? Or are there certain things that you're going to have to be careful of? When you started to go through this and put it into a comic, were there things that you had to be really careful of, or were you watching out for, or did you kind of feel like you had a free hand?
I've been given a lot of free rein from Troma and Ahoy to do what I'm doing here. But, you know, I would say I'm approaching it, I think, faithfully to the character. You know, it's like when you're a fan of a character in, you know, in comics, fans are notorious, right? they love or hate you, and, or what you're doing with the character, or what a writer's doing on a certain run, or how an artist draws a certain character. I mean, with Toxic Avenger, there aren't a ton of comics. So there's a Marvel series from 1991. So there's not like tons and tons of iterations and runs on the character. And it also doesn't originate in comics. So I think that kind of helps what we're doing. Like we're doing a new take. If you like Toxie, there hasn't been a new take in a while. So this is the one you're getting. You know, it's not trying to be the original movies. It can't be, because those are movies and they're made a certain way. They're what they call, proudly call grade Z cinema. And, you know, they're like schlocky and low budget and kind of offensive and fun and intentionally bad. And you can't make an intentionally bad comic, I don't think. So it's kind of different, but you know, I don't know how the fans will react. The early reactions are good. Like we got a couple reviews that were really solid by people who clearly knew very well and liked Toxic Avenger as a character, as a franchise. So far so good. We'll see. You can't please everybody though, right? We'll see.
Yeah, well, I was at a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movie, and I was coming out, and behind me was a father and his young son. And the father says to him, so, well, what'd you think? And the son goes, they always mess up the classics, he goes. And I thought, you know, it's kind of funny because the Turtles have had millions of iterations and stuff like that going around. So I always get nervous when
they
go like that.
It's like, what's that guy talking about? I mean, the original Turtles is the comic book by Eastman and Laird that's extraordinarily violent and awesome, by the way. And, you know, it was immediately turned into a children's cartoon to sell toys. Ones that I loved, by the way, and I was inspired to draw by. But there is, like, the original iteration is a black and white comic, right? Like, that's actually the iteration. The iterations are... I actually just watched the movies, the live-action movies with my kids for the first time the other night. And I felt they held up good. The kids liked it. I hadn't seen him in probably 30-some years.
Well, the kid went on to say he didn't like the new April O'Neil. That was not true to the character on the cartoons.
Uh-oh.
And I was like, and I looked at the father and I said, you're in trouble now. But that's kind of a funny thing. This is that established franchise. Certain fans have certain preconceived notions, which brings me to the question I was mentioning to you, Fred, before we started to record. You now are bringing people to the comics page, and how did you visualize or bring them to this medium? Did you think about them ahead of time? Did you try to follow the movies? Did you have your own concepts? How did you do that?
I poured over a lot of the different versions of Toxic Avenger. And the consistent thing is the one larger eye than the other eye. And that seemed to be a thing. And the large eye is always a little droopy. You know, it's always lower on the face. And I kind of fixated on that. And I'm like, well, I'm gonna see if I can play around with it more and try to come up with a more consistent look for it. Because, you know, when you do a comic book, you want to have the same face for the character so everybody recognizes him. And I didn't want to just rely on the fact that he was green and had tumors all over him. So I even made a clay 3D thing, like so I could light it differently, you know, and it really helped me figure out a more consistent way of drawing the face. And I feel like that's one of the things that a lot of the movies that I only saw the first movie really and bits and pieces of all the other ones. What I notice is because the makeup's never like super like well done, the expressions are kind of lost on the monster. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to be able to make him more expressive and I wanted to light him, you know, use really solid lighting to show how solid a face it was. And so that was my approach. And I kind of brought all those things that I was looking at together. And I figured everybody will just buy into it eventually if it's consistent. And hopefully they'll like our version. So
looks pretty good to me. When I read in the book, I really liked. So I think it's going to work over. I think people are going to like it pretty well. Now, Matt, I got to ask you. There was a news release that came out about this. There was something that made me think immediately of you. I was saying, you know, that said that the Toxic Avenger is being updated to tell a story of environmental devastation, corporate control, and social media mutation. So I'd like to hear more about that. And I'd talk about those things and how they have to do with the Toxic Avenger.
Well, you know, the original movies, I mean, they weren't, I wouldn't consider them very political, but, you know, they come out of the sort of, you know, they started in the early 80s, and I think the milieu they're coming out of is like, you know, toxic waste and corporate dumping, nuclear catastrophes, and concerns about nuclear meltdowns and stuff. And so that's always been in the background, and corporations are definitely, you know, a foe of Toxic Avenger. So, you know, it's the same thing's going on today. Apparently we haven't solved the environmental crisis. Actually, it's just gotten worse. So those are themes in the comic. I mean, you know, I don't want to spoil anything, but there's a corporate conspiracy. It would not shock anyone to learn. And as far as the social media aspect of it, that plays into the bullying of Melvin. So, you know, in kind of all the iterations of Toxic Avenger, he's a meek, bullied nerd, and is, you know, through bullying, ends up in a barrel of toxic waste. And a similar thing happens in this comic, although the bullying is sort of magnified because the bullies in Tromaville have a streaming prank channel that they do live streams on. And so Melvin's humiliation is, you know, magnified through the internet by going viral.
Yeah, that's going to be something to see, because social media has magnified, I think, sometimes the bad elements of things that are going on. And it makes them seem to be a lot bigger than I think they – in the past, we probably would never even heard about a lot of this stuff. But now the social media and YouTube and stuff is just making this stuff all over the place. And you get to be a social media star for 5 minutes and all that stuff. So I'm that made me think of that when I was reading this issue, because, boy – I wish we could get – I keep reading these things on Facebook where people tell me, could you have survived in the 70s or 80s where we didn't have social media and stuff like that? I always have to say, well, I did. I went through that era, and I was surprised. I remember when I bought my first phone, the guy that was sold to me, this is going to change your life, he said to me. And I wish I could find him now, because he was right. I can't get away from anybody now. It's all the we're all over everywhere. So it's just something to see. But are more social media things going to be involved going forward, Matt?
Oh yeah, it's a heavy element of the story. Actually, social media, how it plays out, the bullying, as well as the events. You know, the toxic waste spill and the quarantine of the town and conspiracy theories that arise out of it, some of which may be true and some of which definitely are not.
Okay, that'll be fun. Now, there was another quote that I got a kick out of in the news release from Tom Payer, the editor-in-chief. He said, "The Toxic Avenger delivers what Troma fans want. The series has violent action, gross mutations, bursting pustules, eye-popping visuals, and trenchant humor." And I have to say, all that I think is in the first issue. So it's kind of fun. Now, Fred, what, you know, because when they're ripping people's arms off and stuff like that, is that a challenge for you, or is that something you enjoy portraying? How's that go?
I got to embrace my you know, 12-year-old self of, you know, gross things when I was 12. You know, I would help my dad. My dad would take me hunting. We'd get a deer or we'd get something, and then I'd have to help him cut it up. And, you know, that was sort of, I got familiar with how tendons work and bodies work. And also I like to eat chicken. And I like a good drumstick. So, you know, it's like you kind of like are already immersed in things like that. You just, when you draw it, you're like, oh, that's right. I remember a chicken bone. I had this one tendon that I couldn't bite through. And I remember that. And then I'm like, I'm going to draw something and try to make that, you know, more comical or more descriptive or you know. And try to enhance whatever's going on in the action or the story by being clear. You know, like, I feel like a lot of grossness can get blown away. You know, like people don't embrace it like they could. That, you know, like if you look at it and examine it and go, whoa, where is this thing attached? And I really just enjoy like trying to figure it out and bring clarity to chaos like that. It's kind of one of those things I figured out when I was doing stuff for White Wolf Publishing. They would have these worlds where there's like it's an underworld. They're all, you know, ghosts, I guess, you know, wraiths and things like that. So they're not physically there, kind of. I guess in that world they were, but in when I thought of them, they were like ghosts. I'm like, well, you can like punch right through a ghost, no problem, and you know, that kind of thing. So I explored a lot of really gross things with that project, and because of that, I feel it's really helped me with this project, because everything's mutated. You know, plants are mutated, animals are mutated. I can play around with that and go, wow, what does a chipmunk look like if it's mutated? You know, that's going to be fun, you know? So, I feel like it's a way of exploring new images that people aren't really comfortable with or ready to see. And that's kind of the fun part of doing a comic book like this.
Okay. Well,
and Matt just comes up with these great little touches sometimes, and I'm just like, oh, that's brilliant, let's do that, you know. And I try to go with it and try to enhance it and see how far I can push it.
See, now you just answered my next question. I was going to, did you guys get together and decide what bursting pustules you were going to have in this comic? did you guys do that, Matt?
Not necessarily, I don't think. I don't know, Fred, you can tell me how you remember it, but you know, our editor brought in Fred. Our editor is Tom Pyre. He's a great guy. I knew Fred's work from, you know, his previous Ahoy books that he mentioned. And then, you know, when I first saw his first Toxie, I was like, you know, that's it. That's great. It looks like it, but it's his own twist on things. And I guess, I don't know if we're getting to the level of detail that you're asking about, but like, you know, he's bringing exactly what I want to this book, right? It's just like you said, you know, bursting pustules and stuff. I mean, the first issue is it's not super violent or super gross, in my opinion. I mean, it's maybe grosser than your average comic book, but the second issue, we really go for it.
Oh yeah.
Oh wow. I thought you did a lot in the first issue, so.
Yeah, I feel like there's a scene where he's looking at himself in the mirror as he's transforming in the first issue. And I'm like, I wish I could do 4 pages just on this scene, because it was like, you know, just to examine your body changing in the drastic way that he was doing or that was happening to him. I thought was like a fascinating thing to you know, that we could have visually explored more, you know. But I mean, it would have ruined the story. But I always find things like that. I'll like fixate on a lot of these little details and go, yeah, I think we can push. You know, what if a tumor has a tumor on it? You know, like, you know, like I like how far can we go with these things? You know, what is the inside of his body look like if this is what the outside looks like? You know, like, oh my God, you know. And so there's so much to explore, you know, I think as we do more, it's like you get more in the zone with it. And I feel like that's a really nice, it's really nice when you get to that spot. And I think we were already kind of getting to that spot by by the second issue, where it's like, oh, this is almost natural to draw people with like this hideous deformity.
Okay. Now, there's another sentence, Matt, that you had. You always put sentences in these news releases that intrigue me. In addition to the environmental and action satire at the forefront of the story, Toxic Avenger will skewer corporate PR, influencer culture, and the mainstreaming of conspiracy theories. It isn't paranoia if they're really out to pollute you. you want to expand on that?
You don't have to read even the entire first issue to get what I'm going after with most of that stuff. So we have a nemesis, you might say, is in the form of a PR person, the communications person, I suppose, for Biohazard Solutions is a woman named Lydia Flick, named in part after the great character Tracy Flick from the movie Election. Well, originally a novel, but great movie. And she speaks entirely in corporate PR jargon during this crisis, and is the one who is ostensibly in charge and has to give answers to people, which she does in her roundabout way, using corporate meeting talk and whatnot. And what was the other stuff? The corporation? Yeah, there's a corporation behind it.
Influencer culture.
Yeah, well, that plays into the streaming channel and stuff. And, you know, I don't want to spoil anything, but yeah, I think we get into that. Like, we get into social media a lot, and everybody, because in our world, everybody's online. It affects the real world. And going into the other thing I mentioned in that press release, the conspiracy theories. Those really start erupting, right? Because you got a corporation that's behind this spill. No one really has all the answers. There's mutated teens. It's not hard to imagine it playing out where people get worked up over the wrong thing.
Okay, because teenagers to me are always mutated.
Well, that's part of it. Yeah.
I was a teenager once, but I don't think I ever thought twice that some of these teenagers do. So I'm kind of always baffled by what they're thinking, what they're doing. And I think some of the stuff in the Toxic Avenger in the first issue I started was being baffled at. So it's going to be fascinating to see. They always say, well, people always tell me, well, it's not written for you because you're too old. You just have to understand. But to me, it's like children. I look at a small child and they do stuff and I go, why are they doing that? I can't figure that out. So it's all these things are out. It's all a mystery. Childhood now is a mystery to me as I look back on it. But in some levels, Toxic Avenger is very much kind of a child in some levels as he goes, and he's growing up kind of before us, it seems like. Is that at all accurate, Matt?
I think so. I mean, I would say that he's he's a naive teenager who has to play a hero, and he's not experienced at it. He's still a teenager, even if he's has superheroic strength. So I tried to write him in a way where, you know, one of the fundamental things about Toxic Avenger is that it's a superhero parody. So I wanted to play to that aspect of the franchise when I write Melvin in the Toxic Avenger, which is like, he's the hero of Tromaville, but like ultimately this is a bit of a spoof. Like, you know, he's not Superman or Batman, like the ultra competent, undefeatable, right? Like, a recurring theme in this series is that things are always going wrong. Like, they just keep going wrong and getting worse, which is, you know, supposed to reflect on a few things in our world.
Yeah, I like how you bring in some of the idealism of a teenager too, and with the character, because you're, you know, like when you're the teenagers are talking about their, oh, I want to do this in the future or what, and the way you're writing it, I think really captures some of that essence where a teenager would probably think that, you know, and then seeing that he's a monster or this big, you know, thing after the toxic exposure.
Yeah.
He still has that. It's the same mind, you know? So it's like, wow, I have muscles now. I can do stuff I never dreamed I could do, you know? And, I feel, you know, because if it was a different story, and there wasn't this, dilemma that the story has to address, it'd be more him trying to go, I wonder if I can jump over that building, you know, cause you know, he's like, you got to know what you can do.
Yeah.
You know, like when I get a fast car on the highway, I'm like, I have to stomp on it just to see how fast it will go. You know, so I know, you know, I'm not going to drive like that the whole time.
But. So at least two more things I got to ask about. This all takes place in New Jersey. And I grew up in northeastern Pennsylvania. And as I talked about, children were kind of a mystery. New Jersey was a mystery to me. I couldn't quite figure out what people did there and why they did it. So I'm intrigued that this thing is taking place in New Jersey. And is New Jersey going to play a big role in this matter? Is it just basically, it could be anywhere?
Sort of. I'm not from New Jersey, and I'm not calling a claim to know it well, but it's the setting of Tromaville, the fictional town that trauma movies, especially the Toxic Avenger, take place in. So that's part of it. I don't think you're going to move the Toxic Avenger to San Francisco or Texas. He's New Jersey's first superhero. That's the one of the taglines from the original movies. So, you know, I wrote it as I'm from, you know, mid-sized town in Ohio that I wanted to get out of when I was growing up, deindustrialized Midwest that had seen better days. And so I'm kind of writing it like that. It's a small town. He wants to get out of it. He's bullied. He hates it there. That type of thing.
Okay. Now, the other thing I'm particularly curious about is you mentioned that you had seen the Toxic Crusaders cartoon.
Oh yeah.
Is that are we going to see any characters from that show up, or any kind of storylines and stuff from the cartoon? Is that going to have any influence on the comic book?
Yes. I would say, you know, I wouldn't spoil anything specific, but I haven't been shy about saying two things. First is we're pulling from the Toxic Crusaders for sure. After you read this series as you read the series, you're going to see things from the Toxic Crusaders popping up. I mean, already we're starting with Toxic Avenger and Yvonne, his like half blind girlfriend who is from that show. You'll see other ones, and you know, this is not official or anything, but the plan is to do more of them. I mean, I pitched this as a multi-volume thing, so I have other plans down the road. This is a complete story in this volume, but if enough people buy it and it works, we're gonna make more of these. I have ideas about where this goes.
Do you want that to continue as an ongoing series, or do you want to do occasional miniseries?
Well, I mean, I'll do it whichever way we can do it. The way I understand the comic book market these days is that, you know, it's hard to do an ongoing. So you do mini series.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I guess it'll be a decision based on, I guess, you know, whatever, how the market, right. You know, it'll be out of my control, but I think, if the appetite's there, I know that we'll make more of them.
Okay. Now, of course, we just got the first issue, so I don't want to stop people from going out and getting the first issue. Is it likely that they're going to collect these, the first five into a trade when this is all done?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I would bet on it. I mean, they release everything in trade. But you should go buy the comic book, but you should actually buy it however you want to, you know, at a comic book shop, digitally, waiting for the trade. Obviously I want you to go out to a comic book store and get it because the single issues are important, but really what's important is is getting it any way you can.
Mm-hmm,
yeah, if you get the single issues first, then you'll be the first to know what's in them, as opposed to waiting till they're all.
Oh yeah, all and then yeah, there will be stuff that will just be preserved or won't be preserved, you know, once it's out in trade. But here's another pitch for actually going to the comic book stores. There's versions that are polybagged with trading cards, original trading cards.
Right.
I mean, how cool. So there you go, right? I mean, that's the coolest gimmick in the biz.
That's cool, because there are some card people out there who like those kinds of things. So I think that was a smart idea to do that, to get people to go out and do it. So, well, the first issue now is out, and I got a chance to read it, and I liked it. So I think it's going to be something that particularly Toxie fans are going to really enjoy, because it really is true to what the original movies were, and I think that's going to work really well. So we're going to see how
that goes. I hope so.
We'll have to see it. So get out there and buy this book. That's the only thing we can tell you to do. Speaking of which, as this is, of course, you guys have to work ahead and stuff. Let's start with Fred here. Have you got other projects you're working on that we should be aware of?
Not as far as comics. The New York Comic Convention is coming up, and I'm doing a few signings with Matt, and I'm in an art show for Bronx Brewery that's right by the convention center for a different comic that I did for Z2 Comics. It was stories about Lemmy from Motorhead. So I managed to squeeze that into my schedule over the last year. It was a very short, it was an anthology. So it was a very short story. So I painted it. So it was a fun painting, exercise. So other than that, I'm just doing signings with Matt and enjoying people's feedback on as they see the Toxic Avenger, because that's become my real focus at the right now.
Well, you guys are lucky. You're going to get the New York Comic Con, which is my favorite of the Comic Cons. I prefer that over San Diego Dragon Con.
Oh, cool. I've never been.
Oh, you've never been there?
No.
Oh, wow. Are you guys going to have booths, or are you going to be part of a hoy or what?
No, we're roaming. We got a couple signings, like Fred said. We're signing, I think, on Friday from 10 to 12 at the Bulletproof Comics booth. They're a comic shop in Brooklyn. And then we're doing a signing in Queens at a comic shop, not at the convention, on Saturday. And other than that, I'm meeting up with some people and
drinking,
hanging. Yeah.
Because I have to say, New York Comic Con has one of the best artist alleys I've ever seen. I think people go there with money to burn. And we were there, my roommate and I were there, we were selling a comic, and we had one that was out there for people to look at. And by the end of the convention, we were out of comics, and the only one we had left was the reader copy. And somebody came up and said, "How much for the reader copy?" And we said, "You serious? You want the reader copy? It's been read all weekend long. I'll take it. How much?" "Well, cover price." "Sure thing," he goes. And we were like, "Are you kidding?" And so, I mean, these people, and we took very much less back than what we took. And it was, I love that about that place, is they really are looking for books to buy, especially in the artist alley. And the small press area, not so much, but artist alley, I really have to recommend. It's really good stuff. So, Matt, are there other things you're working on too, or you're just looking forward to the New York as well?
No, I have a new book out, a graphic novel, Justice Warriors Vote Harder, which is
amazing.
It's got more mutants than Toxic Avenger, even. It's a mutant dystopian satire, if you can believe this. It's another comic I do with Ahoy. This one's creator owned. I work with artist Ben Clarkson on that, and it's super fun. Like Toxie, it's ultra violent mutant satire. So everybody should love it.
Is that the end of Justice Warriors, or is there possibly more in the future?
Oh, there's definitely possibly more. We could do 10 volumes of it. We have ideas for tons. So it's just about whether or not people want it. I mean, so far they do. It's doing pretty well, but more people could buy it.
It's really amazing. I was like reading it. Matt sent me a copy, and then I'm pissed. I was on a trip going to Greece, and I was reading it on the plane, and I'm like enjoying all the imagery. And I got halfway through, I left it in Greece. So I'm like, I have to get another one, or I have to go back to Greece. And, but it's such a great, satire and just really smart. It's really awesome.
That's great. Cause we talked about that once on this podcast, Matt. So that was a lot of fun. That's good stuff. Now, Matt,
yeah.
While we're talking with you, Matt, social media, if people want to follow you on social media, where do they go?
Oh, I'm easy to find. I'm on most of the social media apps at this point. And I'm just my name, Matt Bors, B-O-R-S. So easy to find.
Okay, Fred, how about you?
I'm same. Most of my media is Dead Red Fred. Instagram and Facebook's your real name, so Fred Harper. But I've been doing a kind of a Substack lately, and I just post little bits of things I'm working on, and I attempt to write words that make sense, and stuff like that. Otherwise, I'm pretty simple to find.
Okay, Dead Red. I find that interesting.
Yeah, that was a weird. It's a not a long story, but it's a story.
All right. Well, it's called Toxic Avenger number one. It's a 5-issue miniseries from Ahoy. And the first issue is available, so get to your store. If they don't have it, tell them to order it. And be sure to follow up with it, and hopefully we get more. Maybe you'll have Toxic Avenger join the Justice Warriors or something at one point.
don't act like I don't know exactly what would happen. I got it. If we get there, that would be great. Yeah, I would love to have a Toxic Avenger versus Justice Warriors.
That'd be great. Well, you guys keep up the wonderful stuff, and hopefully get to talk with you more about projects in the future. So keep it up.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
Jack Tracks is a spirited satire of those notorious Christian comic tracks that thrilled and traumatized American kids throughout the late 20th century. Its rollicking reexamination of these comics from a contemporary perspective is sure to delight believers and heathens alike. The 10x6 hardcover book is 148 pages long and features work by 74 talented artists around the world. Jack Tracks is edited by cartoonist Danny Hellman, a contributor to DC Comics, Fantagraphics, and countless other publications. He also edited and published the critically acclaimed alternative comics anthologies Legal Actions Comics Volume 1 and 2 and Typhon. So let's see. How you doing, Danny?
Well, I'm so happy that you pronounced Typhon correctly. I published that book, I don't know, it must have been 15 years ago now, and very few people knew how to pronounce that word.
Well, see, I have this thing about pronunciation, and the comics don't provide any way to pronounce anything. And yeah. So my biggest thing is I'm going as well. I'm going to guess, and I do my very best.
So your instinct served you well.
Okay, good on that one. Okay, so let's first thing we got to do. Let's people always get on me because I get involved in the book and then I don't say the things. But this Zoop.gg fundraising campaign is going to end on the 16th of October, which isn't far away. So, and the good news is, even as we're talking, your goal of $5,000 has already been surpassed. So congratulations are in order.
Thank you. That was pretty exciting. We hit that goal, that $5,000 goal, pretty quick. I think it was like 2 or 3 days. Wow. But we actually need to make at least double, if not triple that, mainly because I want to be able to pay my contributing artists a decent page rate. $5K, I don't even think that's enough to make the book break even. I'm not sure why they came up with that 5K goal, but maybe they wanted to come up with a number that we could meet without too much difficulty. I don't know, but yeah, I'm hoping we'll get that number up to 15-20K by the middle of October. God willing. Cool.
Well, this is a good time of year for this book because Halloween's on the horizon. We're getting in October. As soon as October comes, it becomes Halloween month, and so we are there. And I have to read this introductory paragraph because it gives a good idea, I think, for what the book is going to be like. At the very top of the page, it says some readers may want an explanation for this strange book. To them, we say, we took 6 notorious Christian comic booklets that traumatized us as children and asked 74 of the world's most depraved cartoonists to reimagine them page by page. Further explanation would not and will not be offered. Support the campaign for Jack Tracks now, lest you be eternally damned. And, of course, it says for mature audiences only. And, boy, I want to emphasize that last sentence because I think that based on – now, if you go to zoop.gg/C as in cat/jacked tracks, all one word, you can go there and you can go down the page and get to see some of the sample pages and some of what you're going to get to see. And what you're going to buy on it. The size is kind of interesting because it's not – most comic size is taller than it is wide, but this is wider than it is tall. Is that – why did you guys decide to go that route?
Well, the book is kind of a satire slash homage to the Jack Chick Christian tracts that many Americans my age, I'm 60, so when I was a kid in the 70s, you'd find these chick tracts pretty much everywhere, bus stations or strip malls blowing down the street. And I think for a lot of us, we have the shared experience of finding these things, and they're really kind of like digging into our psyches. You know, they were horror comics. They first of all, they were drawn in a very sort of appealing mid-century cartoon style, but the subject matter was horrific. You know, people going to hell and being tortured, and so I think they really made an impression on a lot of American kids. And so when we had the idea to do this book, I thought we would do. You know, I knew I wanted it to be a hardcover, so it would have to be a pretty decent size, but proportionally, it's the same proportions as a chick tract. It's a lot bigger than a chick tract, but it has that horizontal format.
So these were called chick tracts?
Yeah, Jack Chick, who I think is arguably one of the most influential cartoonists of the 20th century. He started doing them, and I'm not nearly as good of a chick historian as lots of other folks are. There's a documentary about him, and there are books written about him. But I'm pretty sure he got his start in the early 60s and started doing these Christian comic booklets and self-publishing them and distributing them. I think that he came up with kind of interesting business model where he would print the booklets and then sell them to churches and pastors that would then use the booklets as kind of like a calling card. They would stamp, you know, contact information for the church or the pastor on the back cover, and they would just hand them out. So they kind of served as promotional materials. And there's just something about the art and the writing that was really arresting. And they're still around today. You know, Chick has been dead for, I don't know, probably a decade or more. But his company is still around and putting the material out there, and you still see it. I was out in a part, I live in Brooklyn here in New York, and there's a wonderful Chinese neighborhood here in Brooklyn called Sunset Park. And my wife and I were out there and passing, you know, a Chinese Christian church, and they actually had Chick tracts posted up on boards outside the church, and they were translated into Chinese, but you know, there's no mistaking the artwork. It's unmistakably one of those Chick tracts, but all in Chinese. So they're still, you know, making an impact.
Now see, this is where I got to confess that, because I grew up Christian and I don't think I've ever seen these.
That's amazing.
I grew up in northeastern Pennsylvania, and I grew up not in a bigger city. I grew up in what they used to call a B-level city, although to this day, I think it's now a C or D-level city. The people like me have been running out of there. And I don't think I've ever seen these. Now, there's an illustration if you go to zoop.gg/c/jacktracts, and there's the illustration. There's a girl sitting, and she's reading some of these, and there's sweat coming off of her because she's horrified by what she's reading. The book she's reading, it says, "You will die." And then there's other ones underneath. This is the Papist plot. And yep. Next Stop Hell. And false idols and stuff that gives you an idea what the books were talking about. Gosh, you know, because I was a comics guy growing up. If I had seen something like this, I would have looked at it at the very least. So I'm it's interesting that I never saw it.
Yeah, I'm amazed that you were able to avoid them, because I grew up in New York, but spent a lot of time out on Long Island, which is very suburban. And out on Long Island, they were everywhere. That's where I first saw them, was floating around, you know, strip malls and train stations. You know, they're always in these weird liminal spaces, you know.
And they have the world. And they had like a place to go if you were interested in finding out more, printed on the back or something?
Well, so the format, you know, I think they're like 18 pages or 22 pages or something. And most of it is a comic strip, but then on the back cover, there's really kind of a blank space, which was left blank intentionally so that churches and pastors could stamp the back of the book with their contact info. And in fact, sometimes you see them even today in the subways here in New York. Occasionally you'll come across some pastor preaching in the subway, and he'll have a table set up, and you'll see these Chick tracts on the tables, and they're using them as a calling card.
Wow. I have never seen them. I'm just astounded at this, because, you know, had I seen a comic somewhere, I would have been straight at it, because I was as a child, I was growing up, and I was ridiculed in the community where they, "You read comic books." I don't know. But if I saw a comic, I shot right after it and wanted to read it. So I don't have to admit, I never saw this, but I take your word for it. I'm sure it's out there, but man, something different. So what was it when you saw this thing in front of that Chinese church that inspired you to make this book? How did you get to decide to do it?
Not exactly. That I think we were already working on the book when we stumbled across that church. The idea for the book was something that came out of a conversation I was having online with two or three other cartoonists. Or I think it was at the start of the COVID pandemic, and we're just talking about different ideas. And I don't know who it was who suggested the idea of taking some of these classic Jack Chick comic strips and getting artists to reinterpret the art. But to me, it sounded like a really fun idea for a project, you know, kind of an experimental thing, you know, along the lines of the author William Burroughs had his famous cut-up technique, where he would take newspaper articles and he would take a razor blade and cut all of the lines of type into different strips and then kind of mix them up and paste them down out of order. And he would then write new text based on this kind of deconstructed text, and new meaning would emerge from it. That's kind of what we're doing with this Jack Tracks book. We took six of the classic Chick comic strips, and I've done a bunch of anthologies over the years, so I have a lot of really talented cartoonists who I've worked with years before. I lined up some of my favorites, and also a bunch of new folks who I met on social media, and I asked them all to redraw the artwork. And then when they turned in their drawings, I wrote a new script. You know, so the art is all new and the text is all new. It really is very much transformed from the original material. And I think it's a lot of fun. You know, I wrote the new text to be as satirical and socially relevant as I could.
Well, there's page 29 that particularly made me smile. There's a person that's obviously in hell, and he says, "Do you guys have smartphones down here?" And one of the devils says, "Well, there's good news and bad news. The good news is, yes, we do have smartphones down here. The bad news is all the smartphones are broken, and Foxconn workers pound them up your ass with a mallet."
Yes. If that's making you smile, I think you'll enjoy the rest of the book, because that's my sense of humor. It's a little bit nasty, very sardonic.
It's funny to me because, you know, everybody's got their head in their phones these days, and I got a huge kick out of the fact that you're taking advantage of that and having fun with that. I thought that was quite funny. Mm-hmm. There's other ones. Sometimes you actually use real Bible verses on the bottom of these little tracks.
Yeah, that was one of the features of the Jack Chick comic tracks, is that he would often have a little footnote at the bottom of the pages with Bible quotes that were supporting points he was trying to make with his narrative. So, you know, because this is kind of a parody of the Chick tracks, I thought, well, I've got to have a lot of these Bible quotes. And I had a lot of fun with those, because sometimes they're Bible quotes and sometimes they're other quotes I just kind of came up with from other sources. In fact, one of those quotes comes from the Necronomicon. I don't know if you're up on your Necronomicon lore, but.
Yeah. But there's another one I like that says, "No talking." And it goes to a psalm, and it says, "Get the coins, wordless comic, got it." Mm-hmm. It says, so that's obviously he's going to give out wordless comics or something and get the coins in exchange, looks like.
Well, that particular strip it's from one of the most famous Chick tracks, and it's called Somebody Loves Me. And it's one of the most brutal of Chick's strips. It was a wordless comic, and it was about a poor little boy who was sent out to beg change by his alcoholic father. And, you know, there's panels of the father beating the kid and the kid's going out into the world and trying to beg change and really not meeting with success. And at the end, the kid just dies, and an angel comes, you know, from heaven and takes him to heaven, because I guess he's he's worthy. So, you know, it's a very intense, violent strip and ripe for parody. And one of the things I wanted to make fun of was the fact that it was a wordless strip. You know, like I have mixed feelings about wordless comic strips. I think sometimes, you know, in the right hands, they can be very effective, but they can also be a little bit corny in the wrong hands. And so I thought it would be fun to just have a strip that's a parody of a pretty well-known wordless strip and have it not be wordless and have it kind of continually referring to the fact that it's supposed to be a wordless strip and yet it isn't. Again, that's my sense of humor.
Now, how did you choose which artist was going to draw what page? It looks like the different pages have different artists on them.
Yeah. Well, it, like I said, I've worked with a lot of these folks on earlier anthologies that I published, and you know, some people are willing to do more work, and some people are only want to do one drawing or two drawings, and some others would say they'd be happy to do six or seven drawings or even more. So first I got a sense of, you know, how much work each artist would be willing to put in. And then, you know, I wanted to kind of evenly distribute. I didn't want to have big chunks of any one person's art. So I kind of tried to spread it out throughout the book. So, you know, make it kind of more varied as you're reading through the book. So as far as how I decided which pages to assign to which artists, I guess, you know, there was a lot of back and forth. I would look at a page and I would say, oh, that looks like something Victor Cairo could draw. And I would send it to Victor and he would look at it and let me know whether it appealed to him or not. So, you know, there were some pages that were, that's the other thing about the Chick tracks is that, you know, like any comic book, there's going to be certain panels that are really exciting and there's going to be other panels that are just boring as hell. And, you know, some of these panels, when I was assigning them, I would tell the artists, look, I know this is a really boring panel, but I encourage you to reinterpret it and, you know, make it more interesting. And they did. You know, a lot of them gave me drawings that were much more interesting than the source material.
So, now, as we're talking, the campaign's going on, and at this point, of course, you've got plenty of time before the campaign comes to an end. It's 11 people have claimed the PDFs for $20. The $40 books have had 79 people pick them up at this point. I'm sure that's going to change before this post. There's two signed ones for $60 and 14 out of 40 remarked ones. So that's pretty good stuff. What kind of remarks are you going to likely do? And you're going to be doing the remarks?
I will be doing the remarks, and I do probably be drawing a whole lot of little cartoon devils.
Okay.
We'll print up like an insert page that'll get, I guess, taped or glued to maybe the inside front cover. I'm not sure how that's going to work exactly, but it will be kind of a sheet that will get pasted into the book. So I'll just be drawing a whole bunch of those for the remarked books.
Okay. Now there's an $85 jacked bundle. You get the hardcover, the pin trio, the epoxy chain, rubber keychain, all kinds of stuff in there with that one. So that there are five of those have been taken already. It doesn't look like there's a limit on that one. And the retailer bundle, you can get three copies of the book for $60, and seven people have already taken that. So they're pretty successful.
Yeah, the retailer bundle is a really good deal. Now, my impression is that comic retailers are not huge fans of crowdfunding because I think they like to be able to return books to the distributor when they don't sell, things like that. So, you know, I'm glad to see that some retailers are going for the retailer bundle, but I, you know, we have to do a little bit of brainstorming in these last couple of weeks of the campaign to figure out alternative routes to get these books into brick and mortar shops. You know, so I have a couple of friends of mine who are alternative distributors who are giving me advice, and I'm about to send a PDF of the book to Diamond in the hope that they'll list it in previews. You know, we'll see. Okay. I haven't dealt with Diamond in over a decade.
Wow.
I'm a little bit nervous about what that process is like here in 2024.
These days, though, there's all kinds of distributors. I mean, there's Lunar, and mm-hmm. there's Penguin, I think, is involved with it and stuff. So if one turns you down, I would go ahead and send it to another couple and see what they say.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to try to hit up as many of them as I can possibly think of.
Now, there's a couple. There's the Pin Trio. I don't know how to pronounce that word. Cloison?
Yeah, I'm not good with that either. I think it's Cloisonné. French word.
Cloison. See, that's the problem. This is why we need pronunciation guides with words that we don't know.
Yeah.
And then there's a sticker pack. 7 different stickers. Each sticker around 4 inches by 4 inches. So all kinds of good things in here for people. And like I said.
Yeah, I produced a bunch of different merchandise items. The Cloisonné pins are particularly nice looking, in my opinion. But we have buttons, we have stickers, we have keychains, 2 different keychains. One of them is made of rubber. The other one is made of kind of plastic or epoxy. There's a fridge magnet. There's all kinds of trinkets and gewgaws that people can pick up to accompany the book, or in the case of the stickers and the pins, they can actually buy them as standalone items. They don't have to buy the book to get the pins or the stickers, because I know there's people out there who are just collectors of pins and stickers.
Okay, now let me see if I can pronounce this right. Typhon Anthology. You can get that.
Got it again.
Okay, $30 for that. How many pages? 192 pages in that. Wow. That's a lot for $30. That's pretty good. And of course, you've got every comic imaginable has a character represented in this, the head of this thing. Well, what's the idea behind that? Well, what's the book about?
Well, Typhon, all right, we have to dial back a few years here. I did a couple of anthologies. This was in, I don't know, back around 1999 and then 2004. Those two books were called Legal Action Comics, Volumes 1 and 2. And they were really intended to raise awareness about a legal case that I had at the time. I was being sued for libel by a cartoonist named Ted Rall, who, you know, was suing me over a joke that I'd sent by email. And he was suing me for some ridiculous sum of money. I think it was $1.5 million. And it was kind of a notorious case back in those days. It's pretty well forgotten now. So we did a couple of books to raise awareness about the case. And so that was Legal Action Comics 1 and 2. And again, there were a lot of different cartoonists contributing all kinds of work for those books. And those were black and white books. And I was getting ready to do a third book when the lawsuit really kind of ran out of gas. It went on for about 5 years and then caused my poor wife, Linda, and I lots of headaches. But eventually the case just kind of petered out before it went to trial. It was really just a nuisance lawsuit. And I had been gearing up to do a third one of these books. So I thought, well, I'll, instead of doing a Legal Action Comics Volume 3, I'll do a whole new book. And that book turned out to be Typhon. And unlike Legal Action Comics 1 and 2, Typhon is full color. It was kind of a much more ambitious production. So it's full color throughout, lots and lots of really beautiful artwork by a lot of different folks. And that cover you described is by Bob Sikoriak, I should probably refer to him as R. Sikoriak, which is how he signs his work. And the monster that you're seeing on the cover, it's he drew Zeus as a small figure on the lower right. And Bob Sikoriak is just a master of cartoon stylistic mimicry. You know, like there's really nobody better at taking on other people's styles and executing them flawlessly. So the character, you know, the Zeus character on the right is lifted from the Zeus we see in Disney's Fantasia during the Beethoven. I think is it the fifth or the sixth? I forget which. The Pastoral Symphony. You know, there's the whole Greek mythology sequence. Mm-hmm. So he's got Zeus from the Disney movie, and then looming on the left is this enormous figure that's just a multi-headed monster that's got, you know, the heads of so many different cartoon characters. Off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you. You know, he's probably got Nancy and Sluggo and Galactus and Green Goblin. Who knows? Who else? He fit a lot of cool characters in there.
Because he's got Garfield and Andy Capp and Fred Flintstone and looks like Betty from Archie Comics. Felix the Cat. Oh, man, we could go probably spend the rest of the time talking about all the different characters. Yeah,
he crammed a lot of cool stuff in there. And so the character out of Greek mythology, Typhon, is, I think, it's either one of the Titans or some other kind of monster that would fight with the gods. And so the multi-headed character is supposed to represent Typhon, this monster figure out of Greek myth. So that's what that cover is about.
Okay, so that's now you've also got for $300, and somebody has taken one original art page. On an original art page by you or Victor Cairo. Mm-hmm. And somebody's taken one of those. I mean, do you know how many of those pages you actually have available?
It says on the Zoop page, I think you can click through to a secondary page that gives you screenshots of the different pieces of original art.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, I see. There's like different ones. Okay, I see. All right, so you got bunches of them in there. So
it's all art from Jack Tracts.
Okay, well that's good. So that's good. And then there's also $40 for limited edition, and I can never pronounce that word. Geikly, Prince Geikly. Mm-hmm.
That's a made up word, I think. It's pronounced Geikly. But I think it's one of these words like Haagen-Dazs that somebody just made up to sound, you know, foreign and exotic. Because really, a Geikly print is just an inkjet print. It's just a slightly more sophisticated inkjet printer. I think it has a couple of different extra nozzles or something. The machines make beautiful color prints. So that's what those are, Geikly prints.
Okay, they're 12 by 12, and there's a variety of them on there. Let's see, at least six on here to start with. So I can imagine those. Nobody's claimed that one yet, but I'm sure that'll happen before the end. Then we get to commissions, 11 by 14 commission, artist choice, unless you request a specific character. You got 3 out of 10 are claimed to that. Do you have any idea? Have they told you what they want already, or are... are you going to basically?
It's a mystery to me. Nobody's told me anything yet. Okay. Are there 3 out of 10? I thought we raised the ceiling on those because I haven't looked at the page today, but last night it looked to me as if most of the commissions had been grabbed up, and I wrote to the Zoop guys and I said maybe we should raise the ceiling because you know we want to hit our 12K goal.
Yeah. It says on here 3 out of 10. So maybe it just hasn't updated yet. And then there's all next to it is a 1 out of 10 claimed by commissioned by Victor Cairo. That one's also 11 by 14 artist choice, unless you request a special or specific character. So that's comes. There's one out of those, and three. Well, you're on your way to get all that good money going, and can help that make that happen. Now, there's also Boo Boos for Beelzebub, limited edition mini comic track signed by Victor Cairo. Did you write that one?
No, this is one of the more interesting pieces of the book. Most of the material in the book is by a lot of different artists for which I wrote all the text. But in the instance of this one tract, this one chick tract, Victor, who's really one of the stars of this book, he did probably more artwork in the book than any other artist, with the possible exception of me. But I think Victor might actually have more art in the book than I do. So he took this chick track called Boo, which was a strip about the evils of Halloween, how, you know, Halloween is the devil's holiday and is corrupting children, and you shouldn't encourage your kids to celebrate Halloween. And it's one of the more scary of the chick tracts. I think it has a serial killer in it. So Victor took the chick tract and just redrew it. And in this instance, he wrote all of the dialogue. So this is 100% Victor. And he really did something special.
Well, there's 31 of those claimed as we're talking. I bet that's going to go up too.
Yeah, and that's a standalone. That's it's a strip that appears in the book. So folks who buy the hardcover book will include Victor's strip, which is called Boo Boos for Beelzebub. But as a special kind of fun side item, I have these printed, you know, these small booklets that are pretty much exactly the same dimensions and format of one of those chick tracts. And we had those printed, and Victor signed them, and we're offering them as kind of an add-on for a little bit extra. You can get Jack Tracts the book, and you can also get the Boo Boos for Beelzebub standalone tract, which is kind of a cool little item, and Victor signed them all.
Boo Boos doesn't make me think serial killer, so that's got something interesting going on in there, I imagine.
It's very wild. It's
okay.
And definitely not for kids.
Yeah. Oh boy, I knew that one right away. Now let's see. As far as the you've got all the luggage tag keychains, epoxy keychains and stuff. I guess you're going to wait until you find out how many you need before you print them and stuff like that.
No, I've actually produced those things. I went a little bit nuts in the last year getting all these different items made up. And I don't know, you know, I'm probably going to be selling these things for the rest of my life. You know, I don't think we're going to be moving them all through this Zoop campaign.
You're not going to go to New York Comic Con, are you?
I'm not a big fan of the New York Comic Con. I've gone, I think, twice, and it's just so big. And, you know, like I really come out of the alternative or underground end of comics. You know, I certainly grew up reading and loving superhero comics, but as I got into my 20s, I got more and more obsessed with the undergrounds, and that's the kind of work that I do. And I feel like a show like the San Diego Con or like the New York Comic Con, those are very, very mainstream shows with lots of cosplay and celebrity signings. And you know, for alternative comics types like me, I do much better at a smaller scale show. Like the show that I really loved, I don't know if these are still happening, but Gabe Fowler, the guy who runs Desert Island, the comic shop in Brooklyn, which is a wonderful comic shop, he and some other folks were organizing these smaller scale shows at Pratt Institute here in Brooklyn. I think the shows were called Comic Arts Brooklyn. And for me, that was just the ideal show because it was, you know, very, very much dedicated to the alternative side of comics. And best of all is that I could get there a short bus ride from my home, unlike SPX or some of these other shows where I've got to figure out how to get cross country.
Yeah, because you know what always bothers me about like indie comics and stuff like that. Oftentimes, stores will like put them. Of course, they don't want kids to get them, so they put them way up high, and like the back of the bus, basically, and it's hard to find them. But some of them I've seen actually make a better deal out of it. But like I said, most of them, they are up in the back, and man, it's just you can forget trying to find them because boy, they're just. And they'll put other stuff in there with it just so they kind of try to deceive you to get in there and look at them. But
some retailers are better at putting that stuff up out front where you can see it. I think for the majority of retailers, most of their business is, Marvel and DC, and that's where they're making their money. So that's what's going to get prime shelf space in their stores. And the alternative stuff kind of gets sidelined. They're in business. They're selling what sells.
Yeah, but you know what? I enjoy variety in my reading, and so for me, I like to. Although I have to say, I was in Washington D.C. and I went into this comic shop, and you had to go up the steps to get into it. And I got up there, and once me and my friends got up there, we started looking around. And there was a guy sitting behind the computer, you know, obviously that's where you checked out, and he never looked at us or spoke to us the whole time we were there. So there was some stuff I was kind of curious about, but I hated to interrupt him if he was playing a game or something on there. So we ended up buying nothing because nobody talked to us. So
that sounds like a very old school comic shop experience. That's how I remember them being when I was in high school. You go to comic shops that felt like, you know, weird clandestine, somewhat shady businesses, and the people running them were not really fit for public interaction. They were weirdos. So, you know, some comic shops are, some retailers are better businessmen than others. Some of them are just not really cut out for being out in public and should probably be doing some kind of online business.
I bet they are now. I mean, that's kind of what they do. I bet those go into it. So once again, the Jack Tracks, and it's going to end on the 16th of this month. And don't wait until then to support it. It's already a success as far as the meeting your goal. But you have bigger goals in mind, so people, don't wait for that. Don't sit back and say, oh, he got his goal, he's done. You can go ahead and get in there and support it, particularly if this is the kind of thing that you enjoy as far as indie comics and good things like that go.
And that's a good time or spot for me to bring up our stretch goal, because the Zoop guys are – professional crowdfunding people. So they said, oh, you got to have a stretch goal. And what we're doing for the Jack Tracks stretch goal is if we hit the 12K target, if we do 12,000 in sales, we're going to add 8 extra pages to the book. So, after all of the material that's already in the book, we'll do 8 pages of just kind of standalone pinup drawings at the back. And I'm going to tap 8 of the heavy hitters in the book to do drawings for those 8 pages. So cool. I'm hoping that people will get out there and help us hit that 12K goal, because not only will it make it, you know, it's already a really fun book, but it'll add 8 more pages of fun, but also it'll bring the numbers up to the point where I can actually pay all my contributors a halfway decent page rate, which is if I can pay them, then it's actually worth their trouble, and maybe even, you know, help them consider doing more art for a sequel. You know, I'd love to do a follow-up book. So hopefully that'll happen.
Would that be Jack Tracks 2?
Something like that. Jack Tracks the Second Coming, or Jack Tracks the Resurrection. You know, the titles write themselves.
There was a book I really liked, and I was always sort of nervous about religious comics because they never quite got it straight the way I wanted it to be. And until I hit this book called Second Coming, Mark Garner, I think not Powell, he'd shoot me because I've interviewed him a couple of times, but that book is really good because Jesus actually meets Superman, basically. And they're roommates. God decides that Jesus is not doing things well enough. He wants to be more like Superman, going around punching and kicking and stuff. And so he puts them two together. But the bad news is that Jesus has more of an influence on it's the son somewhere. It's got a son name to him. It's not actually Superman. But you can tell that's basically who it's founded on. And he has a lot of interesting things to say about organized religion. And I interviewed him. I had to say, I made me think a lot, which I really like. So I'm much more open now to reading comics or things about talking about religion, because maybe we might learn something that we could use in that. So that book kind of put me on a different path. And I that makes me interested to see what kind of things you have in mind.
Well, I mean, that sounds like a fascinating comic. I've never seen that, but I'm going to have to look it up now. And with Jack Tracks, it's not a religious comic per se. You know, I think that it's as much a satire of religious comics as it is a satire of dogmatic atheism. You know, I think it's kind of poking fun at at all kinds of things, you know, so it's not pushing a religious message at all. It's not, you know,
dogmatic.
Unlike the Chick Tracts, it's not telling people you've got to accept Jesus as your savior or you'll go burn in hell.
Dogmatic atheism. I've never heard that phrase before.
Oh, they're out there.
Oh, really? What do they do? I mean, what's their goal?
They're just, you know, they're fervently anti-religious. You know, like, I guess Richard Dawkins or the late Christopher Hitchens would be the foremost dogmatic atheist in my mind. They're out there debating a lot of religious thinkers and trying to poke holes in their thinking.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah,
and you run into a lot of it online. Online is full of strident atheists who will try to argue you into the ground and have, you know, long lists of factoids they can pull out.
Because I used to go online when like a TV show would come out, and I was interested to see what people thought about it. And what I would often get was, you know, there'd be the reasonable people, and then there'd be the big supporters who could do no wrong, and then there was the people that could do no right. And over time, I noticed that the middle people all dropped out, and it all became what I call the gushers versus the bashers. There is no middle ground anymore, and I'm just kind of like, that's why I don't go out there for those kinds of things any longer, because it's just not worth it.
Well, I think that's just that's online culture for you. It it becomes a tug of war between extremes, and people who aren't extreme in their thinking just kind of avoid those arguments. You know, you get the people who love fighting online, and then you get the people who can't stand it, and just it turns them off.
I'm in the latter group there. I'm not interested in arguing with people online. I don't care. But anyway, it's Jack Tracts, and we want to make sure it's very successful so we get more of it. Danny, is there other stuff you're working on we should be aware of?
Well, once I get done with Jack Tracts, the next project I have in front of me is a collection of work that I did for the notorious New York porn tabloid Screw Magazine. I don't know if you've ever come across Screw Magazine. It was a tabloid paper. It published from 1968 to about 2004. And really its business model was ads for sex workers. You know, every major city had one of these papers throughout the 70s and the 80s. What made Screw Magazine unique is that it almost always had artwork on its cover. It didn't have photographs, but it had artwork by some of the legends of underground comics, you know, Robert Crumb and Spain Rodriguez and Vaughn Bode and Kim Deitch. Lots of my heroes from the undergrounds drew covers for Screw in the late 60s, throughout the 70s, and into the 80s. And when I first started working as an illustrator, my first paying jobs were at Screw Magazine. I was a few years out of high school, and I was drawing posters for bands played in New York. And then somebody told me, oh, you can get illustration work up at Screw. They pay not bad. So I took a bunch of my music posters up to Screw, and I met with Screw's art director, Kevin Hine, and he hired me almost immediately. And from 1988 through, like I said, 2004 or so, I was drawing covers for Screw Magazine consistently. I drew over 100 covers for the magazine and lots of artwork for the interior. So Carrero Press, a wonderful publisher out of the UK, is going to collect my artwork for Screw Magazine in a book that the title of which will be The View from Screw. And that will hopefully be making its debut in a year or so. Hopefully not too much more than that.
Okay. All right. Well, again, it's Jack Tracts. You want to get out there on Zoop. Again, it's at zoop.gg/C as in cat/ Jack Tracts, all one word. And again, that's going to end on the 16th of October. Don't wait until then. As soon as you get to hear this, be sure to get out there and support it so that there's a lot more. Even though I met their goal, they got other loftier goals in mind, so be sure to back it. And if people want to follow you online, Danny, are you online anyplace?
I have a website that's in desperate need of repair. It's kind of a mess, so I don't ordinarily steer people to my website, which is www.dannyhellman.com. Really, the best way for folks to see what I'm up to is to follow me on Instagram, on Twitter, or X, or whatever we're calling it, or on Facebook. And really, it's pretty easy to find me. I'm a pretty prolific social media poster/addict. So if you go to any of the big platforms, just look for my name, Danny Hellman, H-E-L-L-M-A-N, and you'll find me. And that URL for the Zoop campaign is kind of tricky. So I do recommend people go either to Instagram, to my Instagram page, or my Twitter/X page, and you'll see me posting about the book and our updates and stuff like crazy.
Very cool. Well, Danny, much success, and hopefully this will be a big success as it is to get more of your work out there. So I hope it really works well.
Well, thank you, Wayne. You've been a pleasure to speak with, and thank you for helping me get the word out about this book, which I think a lot of people are going to enjoy.
If you're enjoying this show, I would greatly appreciate your support. For $5 a month, you can ensure I'm able to bring you interviews with comic creators week after week. You can support this show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/major spoilers. Check out that address, again, patreon.com/major spoilers, for more information. Thanks in advance. And that's it for this week. Be back next time when we'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.